Yogi was mental. Yogi would come into the book room, turn the light off and say, right, all right, my boy's out, leave the Ouija's in here. And we were just off, they would just, they'd fight him, and they'd turn the light out and they'd fight him. He was absolutely mental.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast. I am your host, Ian Stephen, and for today's episode, we visit a member of the Golden Generation in the north of Edinburgh with 14 clubs and 14 under-21 caps to his name and a recent spell in the circus. It's Tam McManus. Tam, how is life treating you? How are you doing?
Life's good. Keep busy, Ian. Busy, and then that's all you can ask for. You know, the bit of stuff in the media, some coaching. And plodding away, so they're okay.
Any interactions recently with former Hearts players accusing you of comic shenanigans?
Oh, but I seen Stefan Adam called me a clown the other day. And that's probably quite mild compared to what I usually get called on Twitter, so I wasn't too bothered with that.
Do you know he actually called you a clown in German because he used a capital C? I don't know if he thought, oh, if I speak in German, Cam will never be able to work out what I'm saying to him.
I didn't know. They didn't tag me. So he's obviously, he put out to the Hearts fans and some Hearts fan tagged me, but, you know, some people were like, I'll be honest.
Were you ever on the pitch with him at the same time?
I don't think I was. I think he was probably just before me. I remember watching the Millennium Derby, which would have been obviously 99 going into 2000. The Hibs won 3-0, and I think he played that night. I think he's still in Big Yogi's pocket, actually. John Hughes. So I'm surprised he got a signal in there to text me.
So if anybody thinks that the Hibs and Hearts derby, it's just everybody's friends, really, in Edinburgh, it's not as bad as Glasgow Celtic, then it clearly is evidence. So the first question we want to kind of ask you is where we always kind of start. Where were you born and brought up, Tam?
So I was born in Stockport Hospital, up in Springburn. And grew up in Ballonlock, which is obviously a stone's throw from Springburn. Lived there till I was about 13, 14. Then we moved to Bishop Briggs with my mum and dad. And played for West Park United, which is a boys' club in Bishop Briggs. I think James McFadden's played there, Burton O'Brien, Kevin Harper. So quite a long list of decent players come through at West Park. And it was then I got picked up for Hibs playing in a Scottish Cup semi-final, I think it was under-15s at Petershill Park. And I scored a hat-trick for West Park that night, and the Hibs scout phoned my house that night and asked me if I would like to get in for the school holidays. So that's kind of where it all started. I started to get into Hibs in the Easter holidays and then the summer holidays, and then I was fortunate enough to get offered a 2-year full-time contract.
So your middle name was Kelly, is that correct? Who was your boyhood? Yes. Who was your boyhood club then, Tam, growing up in Glasgow?
No, mostly my family were Celtic fans. Growing up, a few Rangers fans, but majority Celtic fans. So yeah, I grew up a pretty big Celtic fan when I was young.
Does that allegiance change once you start actually getting emotionally involved with other clubs as a player?
Yep, 100%. I mean, my dad would probably be saying this, so I'm probably more a Hibs fan now than I am a Celtic fan. When you grow up at a club, and I was there from 16 until 23, so it's quite a long time, and it's your kind of formative years as a human being, really, not only as a football player. So, yeah, I would say that probably Hibs now are my club. I spent a long spell there, and I like to see Hibs doing well. If Hibs were playing Celtic in a final, I probably want Hibs to win, to be honest.
To be fair, Tam, you do have a fair long list of suitors to choose from. You certainly you certainly enjoyed signing for clubs. Who was it that gave you your debut, though, when you were at Hibs?
Certainly been Alec McLeish. So the first season I signed for Hibs was, I think, 1997, and it was the season that Jim Duffy came in as a manager at Hibs. I remember him coming in the helicopter and getting announced to the Hibs supporters. And then I think I'm absolutely certain the Hibs beat Celtic in the first game of the season. That was the Chip Charnley goal. And Hibs started really, really strong. I remember being in, I think Hibs were top of the league early doors. And there was a lot of talk about Oakland Hibs challenge and all that, and then it was just a disaster. One defeat after another, and then Jim Duffy ended up getting sacked towards the end of the season. Alec McLeish came in, but he came in too late. I think he came in, there might be five or six teams to go, and Hibs were bottom, and Hibs got relegated. But the following season in the Championship, Alec recruited Frank Sozi, Russell Latipi, Mixed Patalainen. For the first division, and unsurprisingly, Hibs romped it with 20-odd points. And then, towards the end of that season, we were down at Stranraer, and I was on the bench. There was a number of young players that the league we'd already won. And I just wondered if maybe I'd get a sniff of getting on because we'd won the league. And then, I think we were 2 or 3 nothing up at Stranraer, then I get the nod to go on. So that was my debut down at Stranraer. We won 4-0. And I remember the through the goalkeeper having a shot, goalkeeper saved it, and then Kenny Miller tapped it in for his first goal for Hibs as well. So that was my debut. And then the following season, the Hibs won the Premier League. I went out and won East by just to get some experience. And then I made my first start at the end of that season in the last game of the season at Tynecastle against Hearts.
We kind of have to take a step back here because I'm curious as to why Jim Duffy has his own helicopter. I would explain why he went bald at such an early age. I mean, he's over 6 foot. He obviously wasn't ducking under the propellers enough.
I don't know why he came out of a helicopter. I don't know what the script is with that, but I can always remember him coming off a helicopter with his suit on. And it looked like something that he bond. But unfortunately for him and Hibs, a great start to the season just diminished. And, you know, from the early parts of the season, to beating Celtic the first game, to getting relegated was incredible, to be honest. And then obviously Jim left, McLeish came in, and McLeish had a fairly big budget to bring in quality players, and that's when Hibs really started to be a real force to be reckoned with.
Well, I remember that season they spent down in what was the first division back then, now the Championship. Because everywhere they went, the grounds were full. I was at an Air United game and Somerset Park was just absolutely chock full. The Tappy ran the show. He was just a class apart. And it gave Hibs a bounce up into the Premier League the next season, there's no doubt. But for you as a youngster, having somebody like Alec McLeish being your manager at that point, was that just basically a case of yes sir, whatever you say, sir? Awestruck by the kind of level of player he had been?
Yeah, I'll say he was... Alec's probably the best manager I've worked under. I've worked under a lot of managers, but Alec was, you know, he was great tactically. He could, you know, great man manager. And when I first went in, he gave me a 3-year pro contract at the end of my YTS, and then he ripped that up and gave me a 5-year deal. So I think he liked me as a player. He gave me a couple of big contracts, long contracts at Hibs. And I remember playing the reserve game. Alec was still playing at this point. Alec was still playing the reserves. And I was just a young boy coming through. We were playing Dundee United at Penny Pit and Preston Pans. Hibs' reserve. That's where we played the reserve games. And I'd just come on as a sub. I think it was my first reserve game. I think Pat McGinley was playing. Alec McLeish was playing. I was pretty nervous. I was just on and then the ball went out for a corner. I was the closest player to take the corner. And I seen Alec McLeish toddling up, you know, the last 5 minutes of the game, he's blown at his backside and he toddles up for the corner and I hit the first man and Dundee United nearly broke up the part and scored. Right, I seen McLeish try to get back. He was throwing a caravan. And then after the end of the game, you know, he was going through everybody and he says, you, next time you take a corner, you better not hit the first man, he'll be here again. And gave me a roasting for not crossing it in because he had to run back. So he was quite a fearsome character, Alex, at times, but I really liked him, but all the players had respect for him because he obviously, what you said, what he'd done as a player, he commanded that respect, but he just had a good way with players, speaking to players, and with a lot of foreign players at the time, and he managed to gel everybody into one unit. And, you know, that season and then the season after, where Hibs finished third, was two really, really good Hibs teams.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned them already, but I suppose he's become a bit of a Hibs legend. What was it like playing with somebody like Frank Sozi in midfield?
Oh, an incredible player, I remember. So I was in the YTS when Brank signed. So Brank signed in the first division. We were in the first division, which I still find astonishing. And we were cleaning the boots in the old East Stand at Easter Road. And I've seen Alec McLeish, Wally Mackay, the agent, and Frank Sosie walking past the door. And I had known Frank Sosie from the Rangers Marseille games. You know, that was, he was quite a famous player at that time, and he scored against Rangers. And I remember turning around to one of the boys in the boot room going, I think that was Frank Sosie. And they're all like, no, he's not going to be here. And then we walked in the dressing room, and Frank Sosie was sitting in the dressing room. So we played we played an 11v11 bounce game on Easter Road, because Alec McLeish wanted to check if he still had the legs and could run. I think Frank was maybe 34 when he signed for Hibs. And he put the two teams up in the dressing rooms. And it was me and Kenny Miller in one team. And me and Kenny were the two fastest players at the club, hands down. And he put us up against Frank Sosie in the back for the other team. So obviously McLeish was wanting to test them, see if he still had the legs. And I'll never forget this. When the game started, he kicked off. And over 100 metres, I could have given Frank Sosie a 50 metre start and beat him. He couldn't run. And I never get in behind him once that day, near the Kenny, because he read the game so well. Every time we turned to run into the channel, he was already standing there. And I've never ever seen Frank. Now we played 40, 50 games for Hibs, and I've never seen one player outpace him. And he couldn't run. So I don't know how that happened, but he just read the game. He was always one or two steps ahead of the players of Scottish football. And the Hibs fans adore him. I mean, they're probably down as one of the best ever Hibs players, regardless of the kind of small amount of time he was at Easter Road.
What was it then, do you think, helped you start break into the starting 11 of a Hibs team that had quite a lot of quality internationals and experienced pros at that point?
I think the under-21 rule helped. Obviously, every team in the SPL at that point had to have two under-21 players. So that, I think that probably definitely helped. It's maybe something that they should look at again now in terms of younger players, but it was usually me and Ian Murray on the bench. Ian Murray was a utility player. He could play anywhere across the back midfield. I could play up front or I could play wide right. And it was always me and him on the bench. But obviously Hibs, particularly the second season, with Hibs finished third, it was difficult for us to break through because, you know, I think the Hibs strikers were a mixture of Pat Linen, Dirk Lehman, David Zatelli. So it was difficult for me to kind of break through, but I had legs, I could run. I think that's what McLeish liked. You know, the experienced players, Zatelli, Mitsu, Dirk Lehman, but none of them had any pace. So I was used quite frequently off the bench. You know, maybe in the last 10, 15 minutes of games when teams were tiring, you know, they would stick me on, you know, to kind of run in behind and test tiring defenders. So, no, Alec liked me, like me and Ian Murray. We were always involved with the first team from a very young age. And the end of that season, the last game of the season, when Alec gave me my first start, which was Hartford Tynecastle, I ended up playing really well that day. I think Charlie Nicholas gave me the man of the match on Sky. So from that moment on, going into the following season, I was kind of in and about the first team and pushing for a start.
Charlie only gave you man of the match because you're the only name he could pronounce.
Probably.
Did you get to know Mixu while he still had his Finnish accent, or had he become a kind of pseudo-Scot by the time you spoke to him?
Yeah, he's always had a weird accent, Mixu. Obviously, he's spent a lot of time in Scotland, Aberdeen, Dundee United. Then he also came to Hibs, so I don't think anybody would ever see it to his face, but he was quite a ferocious character, to be honest, Mick. So he probably the hardest head I think I've ever seen. You know, the amount of head knocks he took, and it was always the defender that was lying back out, Mick, so we just got up. So I think his head was made of titanium, to be honest. So, Mick was a cracking player. You know, great to play alongside him. I had my best ever season. You know, I played basically a full season alongside Mick, and scored a few goals that season. So he was a great player for a young player to play with because he held the ball up well. He was good in the air, and he kind of bullied the defenders and let you kind of run in behind. So he was a great foil for me.
Well, you speak of that season, and it's the season we're going to be looking at effectively. 2002-2003 for Hibs. And that was a season where a couple of players left for a lot of money. Ulysses de la Cruz and Ulrik Lausen both went for like £1.5 million each. The kind of Setanta money was still kind of semi-floating around at that point, so there was still a bit of money in Scottish football. But that was, nowadays, that's, if Hibs received that amount of money for somebody, they would snap their hands off for them. Maybe not so much with a recent investment, but anybody to get £1.5 million twice in an off-season in Scottish football, the accountants would be delighted.
Yeah, but Ulysses obviously came in from Ecuador, and he was one of our record signings. I think Hibs paid £700,000 for him. And he done really well for us, actually. Scored two great goals in Derby against Hearts and was excellent. Deservedly got a move down to Aston Ballard. I knew Rick Lawson again was excellent. You know, could play left centre back, left wing back, massive, tall guy, perfect for a Martin O'Neill Celtic team. So it was no surprise that Celtic snapped him up, but they were two big players for us. And we went into that season, 2002-2003, with quite a lot of younger players bringing through. Under Bobby Robinson.
You did Zanik Zambernardi that came in as well, and Darius Anderson. Guys like Gary Smith was at the club, very experienced player. But as you say, like Gary O'Connor started dropping in. You also had Derek Riordan that was breaking through. Stephen Whittaker and Scott Brown were also hanging around that squad. It's a kind of very good mix of youth and experience.
Yeah, it was. And to be fair to Bobby Wilson, and I think the Hibs fans have got mixed opinions of Bobby, but to be fair to Bobby, he did play a lot of young players. He gave a lot of people debuts. He gave a lot of people opportunities. And eventually the club sold him on for a lot of money. So I like Bobby. He was pretty simple as a manager. He was get the ball forward. You know, he wasn't the showcase in terms of coaching. You know, he wanted the ball forward. He wanted the ball up to Mixu. And he wanted runners off him. And that's the way we played that whole season, really. Which kind of suited me because I wanted to run in behind all the time. And Mixu were a lot of headers. So I got a few goals just off of running in behind off of Mixu. And him flinging it in. But they put a lot of crosses in the box. Bobby wanted, you know, as soon as you were wide, you know, there was no checking back and go back out the other side or lay it back to a defender. He wanted you to cross the ball. So we were very direct that season. Maybe not the prettiest on the eye, but as we'll probably talk about, I think we took a few scalps that season. And I thought it was quite enjoyable to play in. You know, not as enjoyable as my brief period under Tony Mowbray, where it was complete opposite of Bobby. It was total football. It was playing out for the back. Bobby, you know, wanted the ball forward, he wanted to be direct, and that was just the way he seen the game. But I ended up having my best ever season under Bobby, you know, scoring 11 goals that season. And, you know, I quite enjoyed it because I was playing every week.
Well, it didn't start very well.
No, it didn't, no.
No, lost to Aberdeen, enough, couldn't be expected. But then straight into the Edinburgh Derby. For people who are laymen, for people who don't understand the pressures that's involved with the Edinburgh Derby, what's it like the week beforehand, before for you as a player, before facing Hearts? What's different to the normal run-up to a Saturday game that you'd expect?
Yeah, I just think the whole hype around it. You know, I was living through in Edinburgh at the time, and you know, out and about, you know, you bump into people, you know, and they're always saying, you know, we need to beat Hearts at the weekend, and the Edinburgh News through there, you know, as full of, you know, pace, you know, back to back Edinburgh Derby. And then you have the big press coming in, the Daily Records, the Suns and all that are always in, you know, and you just feel it's a big game. You know, the rivalry between the two teams, and we didn't have a particularly good record against Hearts under Bobby. And we knew going to Tynecastle was always going to be a difficult game. And after losing my first game of the season to Aberdeen, we were in there under a wee bit of pressure. And Mark De Vries made a name for himself that day. He scored 4 goals. And I remember coming on, I think I came on at 3-1 down, and we were pushing to get the next goal. And then they broke up the pub. It was never a 5-1 game, but he broke up the pub twice and put his Celtic Hearts folklore with 4 goals. And we just never got started at all. We started really, really poorly. I think we lost the first 3 or 4, maybe 5 games. And Bobby was under a bit of pressure, to be honest, at that time. But we steadied the ship and managed to get a few results after that. But we struggled against Hearts' physicality. We had, as you said earlier, we had quite a few younger players in Hearts. Hearts of the 2 Scotland centre-half at the time, Randy Webster, Stephen Presley, Craig Gordon, guys like Scott Severn in the middle of the park. You know, they were a strong physical outfit, and we struggled at times to cope with that, particularly at Tynecastle, where they just bombarded you under Craig Levein with crosses and balls in behind.
So after a game like that, usually what happens is manager comes out to speak to the media, a couple of selected players, one will speak to the guys for the Sundays, one will speak to the Mondays. And that's it. You don't really get to see the players much until maybe later on in the week. But what actually happens to you as a player once that final whistle's gone, you've lost 5-1 to your Derby rivals? Do you try to become as inconspicuous as possible, hide for a few days, try to avoid people? Or are you brazen? Do you shake it off, get back on the horse, don't worry about it?
Yeah, it's times, you know, you can see your support streaming out the pitch at the other end, and you know, you've let a lot of people down. You know, you've let the manager down first and foremost, you've let yourself down, and most importantly, you've let the fans down. You know, they've got to get into their work on the Monday and take the stick that comes with that. So there was a lot of pressure on those games. Not to get beat. I think a draw was okay. You know, you could show your face in the Monday, but to get hammered by one was a hammer blow for us. And thankfully, that was before the age of social media, you know, because I think it would be even worse now, you know, with people, fans tagging you and all that stuff. But at least with that, you could just go home and you wouldn't hear anything about it until the following week. So, no, that was a bad one for us, because it was never a 5-1 game, and you know, we were pushing to get the next goal at 3-2 to make it 3-2, and they broke up the part in the injury time and scored 2 goals. So that was a tough one, but you used to shake it off and try to think about the next game.
Did you ever get any fans bump into you in the street and actually give you hassle after a loss?
No, not particularly Hibs fans. It was more us fans. I remember being out a couple of times in Edinburgh, whether that be a bar or a nightclub or whatever, and you know, it was always Hearts fans that would wind you up. You know, it was never Hibs fans. And that was, most of it was good natured, but some of it was out of order. But you just shake off and try to forget about it, to be honest.
See it a lot, especially when, if ever I speak to Old Firm footballers, you can see for the first 30 seconds of the conversation, they're trying to weigh you up to find out what are the chances of this person trying to punch me at some point in this conversation. I wonder if
four teams that have local rivals,
whether that skews their kind of view on humanity and personal relations for the rest of your life, because there's always that worry about that hidden agenda in the background. Sometimes, like, suddenly somebody snaps and starts taking the mickey out of you, you didn't read the situation correctly.
Yeah, I think you always had to be on your guard, to be honest, when you were out and about. Me being from Glasgow, was kind of, I wouldn't say I was gallus, but I was clued in. I felt as if I could smell a situation, you know, try and get out of there quick. And there were a couple of sticky ones in Edinburgh when I was playing with Hibs, with Hearts supporters maybe taking it a bit far, and you know, you just need to get yourself out of there, out of that situation. But you know, I've got sympathy with a lot of footballers, particularly now the higher profile ones, when you've got players taking the mickey out of them. You see it all the time in social media, the Hearts, you know, and Hibs with the 5-1 stuff. You know, a couple of Hearts fans trying to do that, you know, behind your back and wind you up. And then you've seen the stuff with Scott Brown, maybe Rangers fans, and I think Kyle Lafferty with a Celtic fan. So somebody asks for pictures and asks for a signature, then you've got to take them for your word, but some of them are at the wind up. Particularly now with the cameras and all that, and there's just somebody filming it to see your reaction. So I've got a lot of sympathy, but particularly guys at Celtic Rangers now, who, with the age of social media, there's always somebody lurking with a camera or trying, you know, make a story on you. But it wasn't as bad back then because we never had any social media.
Well, the story going back to 2002 was that you hit a really good patch of form after playing Celtic in September, and Kilmarnock, Livingston, Dundee United, Partick Thistle, Aberdeen at Pittodrie, all really, really good results.
Yeah, we started poorly. I mean, we went to Finland in pre-season, that season, and...
Where nobody could understand a word that Mixi was saying.
We went to some place called Oulu, I think it was, and they were saying it was like the suicide capital of Europe or something. There was only a certain amount of daylight, and I'm thinking, why are we here? You know, a pre-season, it must have been Mixi that organised something. And we were there for a week, and we played three friendly games, and I think we had about 6 nights out. So, see, to be honest with you, I think we were just getting fit in September. In that pre-season, we trained hard, but we were off the leash when training finished. So you can imagine all the younger players in Finland, there wasn't much of a curfew, to be honest with you. And we stayed in a hotel that had a nightclub and a casino. I don't think that was particularly thought out well either. Looking back, it's no surprise that we started poorly, because I don't think we were fit, really. Once we got the first 6 or 7 games under the belt, as you say, we started to go on a run and put some results together.
Once you started scoring, they started putting the results together because you get a goal against Killy. That's what kind of kick-started it all off. Then you played Rangers at Ibrox, and you popped up and scored again, and you've made it a kind of habit of scoring at Ibrox, should we say?
Yeah, I've a decent record at Ibrox. I think I scored 3 or 4 goals, different goals there on different occasions.
One of them was sensational, Tam, let's be honest.
And I still get Rangers fans coming up to me now, to be honest, and saying to me, that was one of the best goals I've ever seen for anyone at Ibrox. And I've no idea to this day why I actually hit that first time. I started the game really, really well. I was playing against Michael Ball, who I was absolutely delighted to play against, because before him it was Arthur Newman, and he was a Rolls-Royce player, and I was quick. And I tried to run Arthur Newman a couple of times, and he just, just breezed by me. He was rapid as well. So when Michael Ball was playing, I thought, if I was against him today, and I terrorised him the first 15, 20 minutes. I stuck a ball into the back post for Ian Murray to score to put us, I think it was maybe 1-0 up. And then I was just playing really, really well. My tail was up. And then when that ball came over, I just thought, why not? I was confident, and I'll never hit a better ball than that ever. I mean, that's 99 times out of 100. That's in the sand. But on that occasion, it was sweet as a nut. And Stefan Kloss, a Champions League goalkeeper, was in goal, and it flew by him. So I missed a penalty shortly after that at 2-2, which I don't really mention to people. And we lost 5-2, but That was a special moment for me. Obviously, I'm not a Celtic fan, it's scored at Ibrox, a goal like that.
And then, so you go on a good run through November, leading all the way up to the Derby game, which was played on the 2nd of January. Is that cruel, having a Derby game right after the Christmas period, where instead of you spending time with your family and enjoying yourself, you've always got in the back of your mind, you've got to play Hearts?
Yeah, I mean, that game itself, there was no going out or anything, New Year. You knew that game was coming up. We were fully focused and prepared on that. We were on a good run of form at that point. And we hadn't beaten Hearts under Bobby Olsen. And Bobby was desperate to beat Hearts to get that multi off his back as well. And, that game is another lot of disappointments in my career, but for us to be 4-2 up going into the 92nd minute and draw the game 4-4, that's 20-odd years ago, I still actually can't believe I never won the game. You mentioned Gary Zambernardi there, who was brutal at both the goals, both the Hearts goals. And I remember we were 4-3, and Bobby's asking, I was off at that point, Bobby was asking the fourth official how long left, and he says, 30 seconds. And Yannick, it was at Weed DeBolt's Hearts that scored, and Yannick just kicked the ball straight down to their goalkeeper. Instead of hanging out for a throw in, keeping the ball, do anything bar that. And then I think it was Roddy McKenzie, who was a Hearts bowler, launched it. Mark DeVries flipped it on and Graham Weir scored. And I've never heard a noise like that in my life. You know, the Hearts fans were, you know, they were silly, they thought it was a win, you know, to be 4-2 down in injury time and draw 4 each. So that was a really, really sore one for us, because I'd scored my first Derby goal that game and played really well. But that never really counted for anything because we never won. So that was one of the biggest low points in my career at Hibs, was that 4 each game, because we should have won the game.
Well, it kind of affected kind of form. It wasn't the kind of greatest of form until you found a really kind of interesting way to kind of turn things around, because after a draw against Livingston in April, you had a wee kind of break. There wasn't a game that week. So you decided a few of the players to head out for a night out. And nothing really happened from memory.
This draft, 12.
I'm going to count this time by saying, this is your opportunity to put across a fact, and it's something that I know for a fact is you guys were well and truly stitched up. So
yeah, we were stitched up. You know, I still got the article, and listen, they absolutely done us in. We went out in a team day out in Edinburgh, and maybe 7 or 8 of us. We went to the bar, we went to a strip club, we went to a nightclub, and then we went to a casino. So it was a fairly long night in the drink. And listen, nothing really happened. You know, we were all new to order. We never done any new to order, bar somebody being in an all-star show, which I think was me.
There's somebody else was peeing as well.
All right. So, bar that, you know, we won the order, and I remember the Sunday, picking up that Sunday mail, and the headline was Infamous Five, in the front page, Hibs Stars and 13-hour bender, and I've never, you know, absolutely shit myself, to be honest with you. I turned to page 4, and it was like a 2-page spread inside the Sunday mail, and it was a timeline of where we were being, and, you know, A lot of guys are stitched up. I was stitched up. I was only 21, 22 at the time. I was single, which softened the blow, to be honest with you. My mum and dad were raging, obviously. But some of the guys were married with kids, and they were saying that they were with a woman and in the strip club. And, you know, we got stitched up massively. And then we paid the price for that. We all got fined a week's wages, I think 5 of us. And that money was donated to a good cause, Edinburgh Sick Kids. And then we played Dundee United the week after, and
don't give it away yet, Tam. Let's go through this a wee bit, okay? So if people don't understand, you'll understand this perfectly because you work in the media now, and there's two ways it works. You've got sports journalists that attend games, that talk to players all the time, that form relationships, and do not give the slightest stuff for what you do after the match, if you go for a beer or not. More often than not, the journalists are in the middle of it with some of the players, right? And you've got the guys who write the front pages, the sensationalist journalists, who would have done this without any of the sports team knowing about it, because the sports team would have tipped you off, and you're probably... So it's basically been a case of there's a few players have went out for a few drinks, which is nothing wrong with that. The person I really felt, there's a couple of persons that people I really felt bad for during that incident was, one, Derek Townsley fell asleep and had to be woken up. And
seeing you read that article, you can't believe how much it was. It was an absolute hatchet job.
One Hibs fan who saw the players on their night out said, "They're supposed to be athletes, but look at them. It's no wonder they're in the position they're in." There is no Hibs fan that has ever said that, ever.
No.
And
Okay. There's something about a hedge. They were looking for something in a hedge or something. What's that? There's a quote in it about people conducting a bizarre search of a hedge outside a bath. It's on there somewhere, but it's...
So one of the biggest issue for Hibs was the fact that the doorway that was urinated against was a charity shop run by the Methodist Church. And you remember the referee, Mike McCurry. I'm pretty sure Mike McCurry was a member of either the Methodist or the Baptist Church. So if he's ever sent you off, it's directly as a reason.
He's not sent me off for Hibs.
There you go. But this is the best quote right at the end. Back inside the club, striker Derek Riordan, on loan from Hibs to English club Sunderland, was still partying the night away. He emerged from the private suite to discover he'd been left behind by his teammates. Undeterred, the baby-faced player pulled up a chair alongside a group of drunken lads and continued to make a night off it. He left poor Derek on his Todd, but he didn't care. It didn't matter to him. He was still having fun.
No, it was one of those fear moments where you start to think about what was I doing? You read the article, but I think they've obviously drummed it up and been more sensational to make it a bigger story. But as I said, we weren't out of order. We were just for a night out and maybe we were a wee bit too drunk. But as you spoke about, it led to one of my funniest ever moments, probably the house split.
Well, let's get into that then. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about how your famous goal celebration came about. Talk us into the game.
Yeah, so obviously we are severely under pressure. The next game was Dundee United at Tannadice. And listen, we were all warned to be on my best behaviour. Rod Petrie was absolutely fuming and that was in the paper. You know, he pinned all of his wages. And, you know, we were told to behave ourselves and keep our noses clean. So I just had in my head that if I scored that day, I was going to do a celebration. I was going to jump up on top of the pole behind the goal and slide down it in the style of a stripper. And lo and behold, we got a penalty kick and I managed to send Paul Gallagher the wrong way and I ran towards the pole and jumped up on top of it and slid down it provocatively. So that cost me an hour week's wages, to be honest. Bobby Bungs was absolutely fuming at the side. You know, he was beside himself with age. And then after the game, we won 2-1. We all took him in buzzing and Bobby just went through me, particularly for doing that, for bringing it all back up into the media again. You know, they're trying to sweep it under the carpet and I'd always have done that celebration. But the players, the fans, everybody loved it. They thought it was hilarious. But Bobby and Rod were fuming in the time and all these wages. So that my wage back of that month was particularly light, to be honest.
Do you know what the headline should have been after that? The headline should have read, Hibs heroes raise tens of thousands of pounds for sick kids. That should have been what the action.
Aye. We did, aye. I was doing a substantial sum of money, the 5 years a week's wages, and then I was another week. Donated to Hibs sick kids, so I would have been a few quid.
And everybody kind of reading the article will sit there thinking, do you know what? I would love to go for a night out with Tam McManus. He sounds absolutely hilarious. You went on this massive winning run. After that Livingston game, after the night out, you then went 5 in a row, Dundee United, Aberdeen. Couldn't you stop beating Aberdeen? Motherwell, Livingston, and the only game you actually lost was against Partick last game of the season. So as much as it was an embarrassment for Rod Petrie, it got you 15 points.
Yeah, I think it galvanised the whole squad. I think that, you know, it brought us together closer. And Bobby was big into that. Bobby was into maybe older school, going out and having a drink and team bonding and stuff. And maybe that's what he done when he was a player. I don't think that's obviously done so much now, but that night out and all the pelters we got and the pressure we were under brought everyone together. And, you know, as I said, we'd been on a right good run at the end of that season. And you know, going into the following season, we again lost some experienced players, but that's a season I'll not forget because, you know, obviously I scored 11 goals. I finished the top goal scorer for Hibs, albeit with a meagre 11 goals, but we were a team that didn't create a lot of chances. And I think if you look back on that, you know, didn't miss many because we didn't create many because we had one way of playing and that was a launch to mix and a flick on. You know, we weren't particularly have any flair about us.
I thought you said a lunch to mix it.
No. A big lunch up the park to mix it and I ran in behind, but that was, you know, that was the season when I really made a name for myself by, I was playing most weeks and obviously I scored in the derby game at Tynecastle. I scored two goals at Parkhead and I scored at Ibrox all in the one season as a young player, so That was a really great season for me personally. If not, I think they finished in the bottom six that season. So for the club, it wasn't a great season, but for me personally, it was a really good season.
I think that's a very good point because I think when you score 11 goals for Hibs, you do become obviously valuable as a striker. You become kind of adored by the fans essentially, but you didn't stay at Hibs for your career. So what was it that kick-started you moving away from Easter Road?
So, as I said to you, Alec McLeish had given me a 5-year contract at Hibs, and Alec moved on to Rangers and Frank Sozzi came in, and I played with Frank as a player, and I started under Frank. You know, Frank's first couple of games I was playing, I was, you know, probably the main striker at that point and was doing okay. And Frank wanted to give me another 5-year contract, even though I had 3 years left. So I signed another 5-year contract and then Frank left, Bobby Olsen came in and the money petered away in terms of Scottish football, you know, and I was on quite a big wage at Hibs at that point and a big appearance money. So when Bobby left at the end of that season and Tony Mowbray came into the club, the very first day, Tony came in and says, "Oh, you must have a right good agent, because he's got you a right good contract that we can't afford now." So that wasn't my problem. But Tony made it clear, listen, we need to revise the terms of your contract. You need to take a wage cut, or you need to maybe come to some sort of agreement because we can't pay you that money. We can't play you. And it was weird because I played in pre-season and scored a couple of goals in pre-season and then started the first two league games. But I had a nightmare against Kamal the first game of the season. I missed two or three good chances. We lost 1-0. And then the following game against Motherwell, I get hooked early. And that was me. He had obviously Stephen Fletcher coming through. He'd Deeks, Gary O'Connor. And he signed the boy Sam Morrow from Ipswich and Dean Shields, I think, from Ipswich and Arsenal. So my days were numbered, really. And maybe Tony didn't fancy me, but I think the main crux of it was the contract. They wanted me off the wage bill because I don't think Tony had a particularly big budget at the time. A lot of younger players. So I came to an agreement with Hibs to terminate my contract after a loan spell at Boston, which I hated. And I come back up the road and I ended up leaving Hibs and going up to Dundee to sign for the first Hibs manager I played on, playing was there with Jim Duffy.
Was that relationship that good with Jim for you to go up?
No. I said I was only a young boy at Hibs, and I'll tell you a quick story. So my first day at Hibs coincided with Jim Duffy, you know, coming into Hibs. And we were doing the boots one day, and it was the first day of pre-season, and Jim Duffy came into the away dressing room where all the young players got changed. And he popped his head and he didn't know any of us. We were all the kids. And he says, Who's the fastest player in this dressing room? And they all pointed to me. So he said, "Right, come with me, Tom." So we went to his car and I was chatting away. At least we made it all. We found out that I was from a long block. And we drove to Arthur's Seat. So we get out of the car at Arthur's Seat and you know the steps that go up. There's loads of steps. I don't know the name of them, but there's just a steps like that. So we get out of the car and he says, "Right, I want you to run to the top of the stairs as fast as you can and back with a shout, go." So I said, no bother. He went, go. And I was keen to impress the manager at Hibs. So I was like a scaldy cat. I flew up these steps and flew on the way back down. And he stopped the clock. He went, right, back in the car. So little did I know that was the time that the first team players had to get in. That was the time. So we get back to Easter Road and then we all go, the whole squad goes to the steps. First team boys, Pat McGinley, Chick Chanley, Yogi. And we get to the steps. So Jim Duffy says, right, this is the morning session. We're up and down there 10 times, right? And your time is 55 seconds, right? Or whatever it was. So you got the time for me. So I run up and down the stairs. So the first four or five, no bad. By the time sixth and seventh run comes, the morning starts. There's mostly Yogi. It's this gaffer, this is crap. No, I'm not doing this for. Where did you get these times for? So when I was down at the bottom, he said, where did you get these times for? I thought, surely the gaffer will not say it was me. And he turned around and looked me dead in the eye and says, wee Tam, done the times this morning. So if he can do it in 55 seconds, I'll just can do it. So as you can imagine, the first team boys were screaming abuse at me the whole way up and the whole way back down because I was a busy youngster that flew up and down these steps. And I remember the 9th or 10th, I think Barry Lovetti was getting dragged up. We shot collar because Barry was not the fittest, as you know. And I think the 9th or 10th run, he was calling me all the names under the sun. So it wasn't a great start for me amongst the first team boys. But that was Jim Duffy. And Jim obviously kept tabs on my career. And then I was available to come for Hibs. And I was out of Motherwell and Dundee. And to be honest, Dundee offered me the most money, which is why I signed for Dundee. And looking back, I don't think it was a particularly right move for me.
So, did you actually have John Yogi Hughes as one of your effective mentors as you were a young kid trying to make your way in football?
Yogi was absolutely bananas. I remember we had I don't think the PC brigade would like this now. So we had a young player called Jamie Carter, and he was the height of nothing. He was 5'2" and about 6 stone. So Yogi came in one day and picked him up and says, well, Jamie, come in here. He put him in the balls out of the ball bag and put Jamie Carter in the bag. And he lifted him out onto Easter Road onto the pitch. So Andy, he said, when I shout, I want you to burst it. So Andy Watson was setting the training up and he went into this bag to thought it was a bag of balls. And this young guy shouted out, boot. And I've never seen Andy Watson was raging. He nearly had a heart attack when this young boy jumped through the bag and he thought it was a bag of balls. So Yogi was mental. Yogi would come into the boot room, turn the light off and say, right, all right, my boy's out. Leave the Ouija's in here. And we were just off. They would just duff fight him. And they turn the light out and we'd duff fight him. He was absolutely mental. Obviously, Mellod, who at the time became the manager of Falkirk, actually played, signed me for Falkirk and I played under him at Falkirk. He calmed down a bit. But as a player, he was mental. Absolutely bonkers.
Well, Falkirk was the next club that you went on to. From Dundee, you only made 5 appearances there. Then did the unthinkable, Tam, and you signed for Dunfermline Athletic from Falkirk. I don't know how there's not more scandal about this. Like, there's like Mo Johnson going from Rangers and Celtic. What was your time like with the Pars?
Obviously, it's Falkirk at that point. Yogi signed me, and he's 2 strikers, Anthony Stokes and Alan Gow, and both of them were flying. Robert Lappy was playing behind them, and both of them were banging goals. I think Alan Gow went to Rangers, and Anthony Stokes went to Sunderland for 2 or 3 million. So I couldn't get in the team. I've made 5 sub appeals. I never made 1 start. I just couldn't get in the team. And then I went and seen Yogi in the window, and I said, listen, Yogi, you know, I'm 25 now, I need to be playing. And as a sniff, I got to Dunfermline. Dunfermline bought me the league at the time under Stephen Kenny. Bought me the Premier League. But I played the reserve game against Dunfermline and played really well. And Stephen Kenny I'd inquired to my agent after that. So I knew Dunfermline were sniffing about. So I said to Yogi, listen, can I go? And he wasn't for letting me go. And I had to keep him. You know, Yogi, you know, I've not kicked a ball here for 6 months. You know, I need to go and play. You've got two boys of flight. He says, no, I think you should. I says, no, I'm on your leave. So I eventually we came to a deal to sign for Dunfermline and Stephen Kennedy. And from that moment on, signing with Dunfermline at the end of the season, probably the best spell of form I had. Played really, really well. Scored a few goals, big goals, and we get relegated, I think, the last game of the season or the second last game. But I've played really, really well. You know, I was really fit for my time at Falkirk under Yogi. You know, the hardest sell I've trained. You know, you were in at Stirling University, you were in doing squats and pull-ups before training, and, you know, he really, really worked the players hard. So I was fit, really fit. We had them filming, and unfortunately, we get relegated. And then, following season, Stephen gets sacked pretty early in the championship. And then I got a great opportunity to go to America.
Well, that's a fantastic thing to talk about. A wonderful experience for somebody that's from Glasgow, played in Scotland all their life, other than a trip to the non-American Boston. So how did that move to Colorado get set up? How did that come about?
So my agent was a guy, Dave Baldwin, who lived in Denver at the time. And listen, Dunfermline wanted to offload some of the higher earners. Jim McIntyre came in as the manager, and we were struggling in the first division, and they had to get rid of players. So again, I was kind of scrambling about looking for a club, but I went down in trial for Colorado Rapids for doing their pre-season in London. And Stan Kroenke owned the Colorado Rapids and Arsenal. So the Colorado Rapids had came to Arsenal's training ground for a week to play Arsenal and Ipswich, two friendlies, then do their pre-season here. So my agent phoned me, says, listen, Tim, I've got an opportunity for you to get down to London and train with Colorado Rapids for a week and see how it goes. They're failing my time with. So I flew down to London and done one day's training. And then the next day we were playing Arsenal at Arsenal's training ground. And it was during the international break. So I thought to myself, I hope Arsenal don't play the big guns here, I'm not going to get a kick. And sure as fate, the team came out. And Gilberto was playing, Theo Walcott was playing, Van Persie was playing. Polish goalkeeper, can't remember his name, was in goals. Johan Giroud, Swiss international, was centre half. They're basically a full strength first team, and I was starting the game, and I was thinking, this is not who I want to be going in trial against. We're going to get pumped here. But to be fair, I think all the American boys were pumped up for it, obviously playing Arsenal, and they've seen the names they had. And Arsenal's first team boys were on the ball on their ass, to be honest. So we already beat 2-1, and I played pretty well, set up the goal. And I thought after the game, I've probably done enough to get a contract. And then we played Ipswich a couple of days later. Again, I played well. And then my agent came to me and said, listen, they want to sign you. So amazing for me, I've never even been to America before, even on holiday. And it took me a while to get acclimatised to Colorado, obviously. The altitude, it's a mile above sea level. You know, there's the air's thin, you know, you dry your mouth, all this kind of stuff. And I thought to myself, I'll be fine, I'm for Glasgow. But I struggled initially the first few weeks to train because of the conditions. But I loved my time at Colorado. Unfortunately for me, the manager who signed me got fired midway through the season. And an English guy came in, again, wanted his own players in. So I ended up having to come back to Derry City. In Ireland, Stephen Kenny signed me again for Derry City. And unfortunately, that was the season that they went bust. So after that, it was a bit of a scramble, to be honest, to keep playing football at United for Falkirk. And then I think I finished my career over Limerick in Ireland. So from that move
and,
to
Derry City. And Rochester.
And Rochester Rhinos, which was an interesting move. Again, they were in the league below the MLS, so they were in the kind of championship of American soccer, and they were quite a big club over there. Rochester's quite a big big city in New York State, and enjoyed my time there as well. 2 years there, but they played in Astro Turf every week. They trained on it every day. And I was 32, 33, and suffered some bad injuries throughout my career. And towards the latter end of that second season, the Astro Turf killed my body. You know, I was gone. My Achilles was knackered. And I managed to soldier on to the end of that season and then ended up, I think, coming back to Limerick. Spent 6 months over there, but by that point, my body had chucked it. I just couldn't. I wasn't the same player I was when I was younger.
Were you married with kids or just married at the point of having to move over to America, Tam?
Yes, so I just started seeing my new wife, Mary. I just started seeing her when I was at Falkirk. So she was with me, Falkirk, Dunfermline, and then she came over to Denver with me, which she loved, going to Denver. Denny, after Denver, there was disaffected Denny. Wasn't quite the same as Denver. She went everywhere with me, whether that was Colorado, Derry City, Limerick, Rochester, New York. So she was, you know, she sacrificed a lot for my career as well, which I'm grateful for because she had her own career. But she came over with me and followed me about. So it was great. Listen, it was up until Bolivar, Derry City, where they went busting with a lot of financial problems. Up until then, my career was going pretty well. But after that, it was a scramble to stay within football because not a lot of clubs had money for an aging striker. So you just had to take what you got. And I managed to pass a decent spell at Falkirk and then back over to America. Prolonged my career there until I was about 34. And then short spell in the juniors, we got Cairn Juniors. You know, I think from the Rochester experience, from training on that after turf every day, my body had broken down. I just couldn't train every day anymore. I was constant pain. And you know, I think enough's enough. Your body tells you when enough's enough. And that was probably after I came back from Rochester.
Was there any hankering to get into coaching or management in football?
Well, I've done my badges, I've done my B license in the A, and I'm a coach at Breakhurst. I'm involved in performance field at Breakhurst. I've been there for 5 years now, coaching the kids there. So that's only during the week. That's maybe 2 or 3 days a week, and you can put them back to their clubs at the weekend. You don't need to deal with, you know, picking teams and all that. It's just individual coaching. So I really enjoy that. In terms of will I ever be a manager, probably not. I think that when you look at the pressure from guys like me, ironically, put under, now involved in the media, you know, and managers are for 5 or 6 games away from being under pressure, particularly bigger clubs, Hearts, Hibs, Celtic Rangers. I think it's a very difficult industry to get involved in. And I've got a lot of sympathy for managers who go in, particularly young managers, and the pressure they're under. I'm good friends with Stephen Hamill, seen how it affected him at Motherwell. So I'm doing okay doing what I'm doing now. You know, I built up a decent wee life in terms of what I'm doing, and to give all that up to maybe go into management, I don't think it's worth the risk. And I like a wee gamble, but I don't think that's one that I fancy gambling, to be honest.
That was part of the report all those years ago. Where's the quote? I'm gonna have to find it. Where
that is, I remember. Also a keen gambler.
Yep. McManus also known as a keen gambler. How are you known as a keen gambler? Like 21?
I know.
Do people keep spotting you outside Musselburgh races or something?
That was a sitch up, as I said. But it's one of those things, you know, if I could go back and I wouldn't do it, but it was a night out.
You kidding? I'd save up to go out with you. That sounded like an awesome bit. I'm 21. That's like the greatest night of my life.
It was an absolutely brilliant day. And it all started by me driving back to Glasgow, and Grant Brebner phoned me and told me to turn back while the boys were out the night out. So I should have just rolled back to Glasgow, and this would never have happened. But I've turned back, met Grant, met the boys in Edinburgh, and the rest, as they say, is history. But it very nearly never happened if I just drove home.
I know what you're saying about getting the fear when the stuff in the paper, because I had a friend, a guy called Stevie Bonner, and he played for like Rafe, played for Stranraer, played for Dumbarton. And one day when he was at Dumbarton, I think this was the lowest tier at that point in professional, he got taken off and he didn't see his manager trying to high-five him when he got taken off. He just went to the bench. The manager comes in and he says, this is no Stevie Bonner FC. This is Dumbarton FC. So this was the quote. And it goes out in the paper. And it's not even like in the front pages or anything, but Stevie was telling me that the next week, he's like, I had about 100 text messages before I woke up. I had no idea what I was going. This is Dumbarton. So I can appreciate exactly if you're in a kind of full page spread, then it must have been panic time.
Yeah, but I think the most embarrassing thing was for my parents. My mum had to get to work on the Monday, and it wasn't any nice for her to have basically that boy been told, you know, that he was a pervert, he was, you know, a gambler. You know, he was peeing in charity doorways, and you know, I don't think it was a good breed for her, to be honest. Me, I just found it funny at the time, but I think my mum was pretty embarrassed about it, and I'm not allowed to mention it now. Even now, when I'm in the house, she doesn't look back in that period fondly. But my dad, I think my dad was too bothered about it. He thought must have been a good night out.
your dad secretly goes, lucky little bugger. Right, well, I think on that note, I think it's time to end this week's episode. My thanks to Tam McManus for not urinating anywhere during this podcast. Also, thanks for donating tens of thousands of pounds to Sick Kids, which we've also found out. We're off to the casino together, and we're not taking Derek Redden with us. Join us next week for another forensic.
He's still balanced everything. He's still balanced everything up in Edinburgh. He got a lifetime bandits.
Oh, I need to get him on this episode. Surely he'll talk. So our website's www.csi.com. You can find all our socials there. So until next week, cheery bye and thank you. Thanks, Tam.